or near enough. Sick and tired of that old man looking down on us. Come together as we think we got a plan. Save a teeny tiny traveling folk band.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Flat Nickel Podcast. I am your host, Hannah Nawa, not joined by my co-host and producer, Mr. Sam Fritz, for this intro, but he is in this week's episode. This week's episode is with Kevin Neidig. We sat down with him in Hershey Violins in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania, to discuss with him his new album that he just came out with, playing the Olympics. He played at the Olympics, and that was an incredible story to hear about, and also talked about Sonic Reiki. So if you're curious as to what Sonic Reiki is, then you're definitely going to want to listen to this episode, because I was very curious as to what it was. But it's a really fun episode. We had a great time sitting down with him, and I hope that you guys enjoy this episode. Without further ado, let's go ahead and hop in to our interview with Kevin Neidig. Decided that we're gonna name this microphone.
It doesn't have a name yet, but
because I name everything. Like my mother, when I was a little kid, she was like, I don't understand why you name all your stuffed animals. I had one stuffed animal as a child, and I didn't even name it. But I give everything a name. My car's name is Dorothy, after the singer of the rock band of the same name. But I think we should put out a poll on what we should name our compressor mic that has been doing us so well. We started out with two overhead drum mic AKG mics that picked up everything, because that was just the highest quality mic we had at the time. We're like, let's just test this out and see what happens. It wasn't that great. It was a lot of mouth noises and hissing that you could hear all the time.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Crackling water bottles were a big factor.
A big, big problem. And then we started using the SM...
250?
Something. Yeah. Whatever is industry standard for, like, stage microphones.
Oh, yeah.
And we use that and the compressor mic if it's a bigger group. But this is nice and cozy and intimate here at Hershey Violins, surrounded by delightful prints, which we will probably take a picture of and share on our Instagram, because these are all really cool and three-dimensional and just really neat art prints on the walls.
Yeah, most of these were actually done by Debbie Hershey, who is the wife of Scott Hershey, who owns the building. There's a couple of John Fraser's pieces. There's three of them on the wall over there, but everything else is Debbie's.
I know, it's very very unique and very cool, bright art.
Yeah,
you don't see
awesome.
You don't see a lot of that pop. But anyway, we'll start the interview now. Our little chit chat. Get close out of Groupon. We were having a Sam was trying to explain to me how Groupon works while we were waiting. We were just like, I'm like, I signed up for emails. I don't know why. And I was like, oh, look, there's a Groupon for the Carlisle Sports Emporium, which is my new addiction. And I was trying to figure out how Groupon works, because I still don't quite get it. But commencing the interview and preparing the interview questions. So I went to your website.
Yes.
I went into your bio. I learned a lot of things.
Yeah.
That I didn't know about you.
Well, that's good.
Because the two things that I know about you are that you are an excellent musician.
Well, thank you.
And that you've got a song about having too many things in your pockets.
The old pocket song.
The old pocket song, which when we scheduled this interview, my mother was very quick to share with Sam the pocket song.
Awesome.
Because it is my mother's favorite song, and it is definitely always a crowd pleaser. But I went into your bio, read through it, discovered a lot of things that I want to ask you about, and hopefully share with our listeners your story, because I saw on your website you have 15 recordings that were listed on there through different projects.
Yeah, about that, yep.
And you have a new album coming out.
Yes.
At the end of this month.
Well, the album's out already.
Oh, it is?
The album released last, like a week and a half ago.
Okay.
But today is Wednesday. Friday is the CD release party.
Gotcha.
For that, yeah.
Yes, I heard of that. This new album, you recorded yourself, correct?
Yes.
And you recorded, produced.
Everything
was all you.
All of it, yeah.
Throughout your long expansion of discography? I don't know if that's correct.
Yeah.
It is? Okay. Yeah. Has the recording process changed? Have you done albums in studios? You've also been in groups. You've recorded by yourself.
Yes, I've recorded a bunch in the studio, and I'm like, I know enough to be dangerous in the studio, and I feel like I want to try this. Oh, try this, try this, try this. And if I actually say that to the engineer, he's going to smack me, you know? So to me, like, if I can sit behind the console and turn the knobs, then, you know, I can just kind of hone in what I want, you know, like, well, maybe I want the balance to be a little bit different. Oh, well, I'll listen to that for a little bit. Oh, I don't like that. I want to pan it hard right and hard left and see what that sounds like. And so it's kind of like a lot of experimentation, and it doesn't cost me anything to do it. You know, it doesn't cost me any time. So, I mean, I really like recording myself. There are advantages to having someone else do it, just having another set of ears in there. And at the same time, I feel like I can be more creative when I do it on my own and take my time. It does take longer. It takes a lot longer when I'm doing it by myself, pushing the buttons and then make sure I'm in tune and all that stuff. But yeah, I think almost all of my albums I've recorded myself. And if you listen to them in order, I think you can kind of hear that they get better and better as time goes on, as the more I learn about mixing sound and things. So yeah, the techniques change.
Yeah. Did you record this album in your house? Was it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a little music room that has all my guitars and things on the walls. So I just recorded in there.
What kind of equipment? Because a lot of people, a good amount of people that I talked to, not that we've interviewed, but that I've spoken to personally, have recorded their own albums or their own EPs. For people who might be interested in going that way, what kind of equipment are you using? What kind of software are you using?
So I just recently got an iMac.
Okay.
And so I use that. I have a MacBook Pro as well, which I was recording on that. The iMac is nicer because it's, you know, a 27-inch screen, so it's a lot easier to see the files and things. But I record on that. I use Logic as my DAW. And I have an Apogee Duet that I use to plug the microphones into. So that's the Duet has all the preamps in it and converts the analog into digital, which goes into the computer. And so basically I can record two tracks at once. You know, so because I record almost all of the instruments, I sing, I do the harmonies, guitar, ukulele, some bass. I have a friend of mine who plays upright bass, Bruce Campbell, who played on it. What did I say? Banjo, mandolin, a whole slide. So I can't play all those at once. So having two tracks is fine for me. But that's what I use. And I just use all the stock reverbs and compressors and stuff that come with Logic. And it sounds great.
I will be 100% honest and say, not a lot of that made sense to me.
We discussed
earlier that I am not the brains when it comes to the technology. That is strictly Sam's forte. We had a bit of a discussion because I didn't know what the front of the microphone was. but I am sure that people who do understand technology will find that much more helpful.
Yes. Well, you asked a technical question.
I'm asking for the listeners, you know? Like, I don't know these things.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'll ever understand these things, but the listeners need to know. The people need to know.
And actually, I really only used one microphone on the whole project, which is usually not what people do. And there's a company called Ear Trumpet that they hand make microphones in Portland. And they look like, if you've ever seen one, they look like an old school, like, radio microphone. They're made out of copper or brass pipe. It has like springs on it, and but you know they're relatively inexpensive mics, but they sound incredible. So I was like, I want to do a whole album and just use that one mic and to see how good it sounds, what it can do, and it did it. So
I'm all about stuff made in the USA, so that's really nifty because totally. Normally you would use different microphones for recording instruments than you would for vocals, right?
Yeah,
I think from the only ever recordings that I've seen being made, that was typical. But you were able to use this one microphone,
yeah,
and have it sound the way you wanted.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah, and plus I'm poor, so you know, I mean there is that. So we use one microphone. We use the
reduce, reuse, recycle. You exactly. know, reduce your microphones, and it'll all work out. That's really cool. We'll post a link to that brand when we release this episode because I like the sound of that.
Yeah, cool.
Man, there's so much to talk to you about. But I guess let's start with man, these are all just such interesting topics. I don't even know where to start at this point. One of the things that I saw on there was you started a side project using sound as healing therapy.
Yes.
Which you deemed Sonic Reiki.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. I need to know, how did you discover this process? How does it work? I know what Reiki is normally. But I'm very intrigued by this.
Okay, so if you're familiar with Reiki, I mean, a lot of people think of that as like hands-on healing kind mm-hmm. of thing. Reiki, chi, prana, life force energy, all of that kind of stuff, it's all the same thing. The source field, as David Wilcock calls it, if you are familiar with him. So the energy that composes everything, the whole universe is alive with this energy, and if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here, right? I mean, and if you think about all of it, at least in our vicinity, comes from the sun. So you know, the sun gives off water, it gives off energy, it gives off light. The plants grow from that. The animals eat the plants. People unfortunately eat the animals, and you know, all of that comes from the sun. So that kind of energy is surrounding us. So that is, to me, that's the Reiki aspect mm-hmm. of it. The sonic is the sound, is the vibration. So in sound healing, you have the actual physical manifestation of the sound, usually through the voice. You can do it through instruments. People use gongs, they use tuning forks, they use guitars, you know, anything, drums, all of that stuff has a particular energy to it, and it moves people in a certain way. And so when you have that sound and you have an intention behind that sound, you can create something. Mm-hmm. So when there were studies done where you would have an orchestra play the same piece, I don't remember what the piece was, but they had a different conductor, like maybe five different conductors. The orchestra stays the same, they play it and they record it. And then they take those recordings and they give them to people and they say, you know, what is your favorite one? And so it turned out, even though it was the same people playing the music, they kept picking the same conductor. You know, like, well, why is that? Why are they picking that one conductor? And they didn't even know. They're just hearing five different versions. And the reason is like, well, that conductor has like some kind of intention. He has this, or she, they have this power to like bring something about. So the intention is really important. And, you know, as I try my best to try to infuse that into all of my albums, you know, just have it a very high vibratory, you know, not dark and mm-hmm. and kind of murky. But we're just talking, it's all metaphysical, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's like some people would listen to my stuff and go, meh, and throw it out. And then somebody else might hear it and go, what is that? You know what I mean? So like there's a, you know, like attracts like. So that's like for everything. So I put that in the albums that I create with regular music, and then I have a couple of meditation albums that I use. And I started learning that stuff, I would say full force, when I went to, there's a sound healing intensive in Colorado every year that Jonathan Goldman does. And it's 9 days, and you go there and you're immersed in like sound healing, chanting, all of that stuff. And so you learn how to do different things and to use it for healing people and changing consciousness levels and all of that kind of stuff. It was awesome. So so I try to put that into my music and into the sound healing CDs.
You mentioned Jonathan Goldman, which one of my questions was, what influences or projects have sort of, would you consider to be turning points in your career? People who you've interacted with or started other projects with or co-wrote with, anything like that, that has sort of either changed the direction of your sound or changed your view on how you want to make music. That seems like he might be one of those people.
I wouldn't say that he had changed the direction of my music, but just made me a little bit more aware of my intention behind it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I don't know. Like, I think the only time I can think of that I really changed what I was doing, because I started playing music when I was 3. You know, I was playing the keyboard. And then I moved the drums, and then after a while, I couldn't stand the drums. I wanted melody, and then I had gone to guitar, and then, you know, I was playing, like, heavy metal stuff. I was doing Black Sabbath and Metallica and Megadeth and Anthrax. I mean, Dream Theater, you name it, like, all of that stuff was, I was totally into that. And there was one, and I had played bluegrass in that, but really, like, the metal, progressive metal kind of stuff was what I was really into. But then I heard a band called Newgrass Revival, and it was like, after one song, I was like, oh, what is that? I want more of this, you know? It was, I had never heard anything like that before. And so that was completely life-altering. So I, you know, my electric guitar, I still have it. I have a couple of them, but they just hang on the wall. You know, acoustic music is, after that, I was sold. Like, this is where it is.
As far as the instruments you play, for the people who aren't familiar, what all do you play? And is there a particular instrument that you have in your collection that you feel particularly attached to?
Yeah, all the instruments, pretty much anything with strings and frets. There are a couple other ones. Like, I play didgeridoo and... like I said, I play drums, but guitar, mandolin, banjo, bass, ukulele. I don't know. There's a whole bunch, but guitar is my main instrument. I mean, I love that. And the one guitar I have is a Collings guitar that is sort of built. It's a dreadnought, but it's one of the bigger dreadnoughts. It's like one of the original Martin body styles. So the body is a little bit bigger than normal. The fretboard is wider than normal. And it's not a typical guitar that you see played out there, but I love that instrument. And I was playing a gig one time, and it was outside, and the wind blew a speaker over, and it came down and crushed it. It was like demolished, splinters everywhere. The whole thing was busted out, and I was pretty upset. But the good news is...
I was going to say, is it...
the light at the end of the tunnel is that I knew a guy who built guitars and things like that. And he goes, you know, I need a winter project. I'll take the guitar. And he gave me a rain song guitar to play, which was, like, terrible. But, sorry, rain song. And so he had the guitar for... 4 years, and he fixed it, and he said that every little splinter because it was in a gig bag, so it was like kind of like closed in. And he said every splinter was put back. There wasn't anything that he didn't leave out, you know. And it became his favorite guitar. And he's got tons of instruments. And he wouldn't sell it back to me for years. And I kept bugging him. And finally, he gave in and sold it back to me. So I have it, and I'm happy.
Well, during our break, we were talking about lessons, and I think actually a good way to possibly lead back into that, I have this question here as to, you teach lessons here.
Yes.
In a, I assume a variety of instruments, because my dad takes banjo lessons.
Yep.
And I'm assuming guitar lessons.
Guitar lessons, voice lessons, mandolin, ukulele, bass.
A wide variety.
Yeah.
But something I was thinking about was, you know, advice for musicians. A lot of times musicians will, or at least the ones that we've spoken to, sort of stick with the same instrument and not really venture off from it. But for those who are wanting to start a new instrument, sort of, I guess, you know, advice for them, or is there anything that pairs up nicely together? Like, if you play this, then this might be...
Yeah, if... Well, let's say, because most people play guitar, mandolin is an awesome addition, and banjo is an awesome addition. Ukulele is pretty easy. I mean, the four strings of a ukulele is essentially the bottom four strings of a guitar. You just have some techniques to learn, and it could add different textures into your playing, and definitely recommend that. I think if, you know, some people come up to me and they're like, well, what can you give me? Like, what's the advice you can give me that I can get better? And, you know, because I'm struggling, you know, everybody hits that brick wall, you know, I'm stuck in a rut. I don't know how to get out of it. You know, I keep playing the same things over and over again. And, you know, it's like, you know, don't play the same things over and over again. Not your problem. See ya. Have a nice life. You know, it's kind of like, doctor, it hurts when I touch this. Well, don't touch that. It seems kind of obvious, but actually the biggest thing I would say is immersion. Like if you're trying to learn guitar, if you want to get better at guitar, or you want to learn a new instrument, immerse yourself in that. And that means listen to music that is above your skill level. Maybe instrumental music, maybe, I don't know, I could name a bunch of people that are fantastic players, but listen to it constantly, and not in the background, but listen to it with conscious awareness. Like you listen to something, it's like, oh, well, that was cool. That was a really fast lick. Or maybe you go, oh, that was a minor chord. That was a major chord. Or maybe you can go deeper and go, oh man, he's using pentatonic scale there. Oh, that was a triplet. That was, you know, oh, he's picking it differently right there. You know, so that's consciously listening. And even if you can't go that deep, keep listening and keep listening, and eventually you'll get there, so that when you listen to something, you'll get to the point where you can play it. You know, because if it's not in your head, if it's not in your ear, it ain't coming out of your fingers. You know, it just doesn't work that way. If I want to play bluegrass music, I can't just show you like a boom chuck rhythm and then have you be a fantastic bluegrass player. You got to listen to bluegrass. You got to listen to how those players play, so that when you play, that is running in your brain, so it comes out of you, and in your own way. I mean, everybody wants to put their own stamp on it, but immersion, that is the biggest key.
Is there something that you don't play that you want to learn how to play?
I play a little bit of violin, and it's ugly. It's very ugly, but I really like violin, and I really like piano, but you know, I'm lame at best on the piano compared to the other instruments, but I want to get better at those, and I am working on those.
You've been able to play shows in a very wide variety of locations, I've been told. What have been some of the most exciting venues that you've been able to perform at?
The Olympics, definitely. That was a big one. The biggest takeaway from there is I played in Park City and on this gigantic stage. It was like, you know, giant stadium, giant speakers and all that stuff. And so we're outside and we're playing for Olympic Village. So all of the athletes are out there and they're just kind of hanging out. And I mean, there's tons of people. And it's also like 30 degrees. So I'm on stage playing and it's snowing. Right outside, I'm all bundled up. I don't know how many layers I had on, and I had gloves on that I had cut the fingers off of, and I had hand warmers that you know, you break them open, and so I had one on the front, one on the back, on both hands. So like my hands were heavier than normal, and I got to play this giant instrumental song that I normally do with this like gloves on my hands. So that was pretty awesome.
Just for the listener, what year Olympics was this?
That was
2002.
Yeah, 2002.
The 2002 winner. What's the reaction to being asked to play the Olympic Village? Like when you get that call or that email, you know.
It's overwhelming. I mean, how many people get to do that? It's pretty awesome, and you know, we just asked. It wasn't.
Oh, you asked to play.
Yeah. Okay. Just how do we play the Olympics? Because we knew some people that lived in Salt Lake City. Like, oh, Olympics are coming to Salt Lake City. Let's try to play the Olympics. So called the Olympic Committee. Hey, we want to play. Send some stuff. And they're like, okay.
Huh.
And it was like, okay, really?
I don't imagine it being that easy.
It was.
I shouldn't say that easy to get approved, but that easy to like just even submit.
Right.
You know, I feel like the submission process would be layers upon layers.
Yeah. No, it was pretty easy.
Huh. I mean,
sometimes it just works that way.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that are just arduous, and we just press on and press on and press on, and nothing seems to happen, and all of a sudden, boom. Like, oh, good. That makes me happy.
And also, festivals. You've played some pretty cool, some local festivals and some other festivals. There was the fairy festival?
The Fairy Festival, which is no more.
It doesn't exist anymore?
It doesn't. I think this year was the last year.
Oh no. Do we know why?
I think the people that ran it decided that they were going to retire and their kids didn't want to take it over. If I have that story correct.
I've heard a lot about it over the years. I have a friend that does henna, and I think she would go and set up, or she would go.
Okay.
I feel like I've seen a couple of my friends go over the years. But you've played those sort of settings, the sort of festival settings.
Oh, yeah.
Do you enjoy it? How do you feel about playing festivals? Is it different than playing other venues? How is it different?
Yeah, the festivals don't have the intimacy, so, you know, sets get adjusted for that. You know, a lot of times you want to kind of have like more of an intense kind of set. But I mean, festivals are awesome because you usually get a bigger sound system, you know, there's more people. Just the atmosphere is great. The folk festival, Falcon Ridge, which is up in New York, I played that one as a emerging artist. They have this series, you kind of, same deal, you submit stuff and then they pick, oh, these are the best of the ones that we got, and I got to perform for that. That one's great. There was another one in the Connecticut Folk Festival, which is awesome. So there are some festivals that I would love to play, but haven't yet. You know, like Merle Fest would be fantastic. I would love to play Telluride. I mean, there's just great acoustic festivals out there now.
I feel like a lot of people we've spoken to have had very mixed feelings on festivals. Because we were talking about festivals previously, and it was one of those things where the sort of festival culture, I remember someone saying, isn't good for merch sales.
Oh, really?
Because, I guess depending on the festival, I think an arts festival can sometimes be different.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've had two different mindsets, because right now our two main interview genres have been alternative rock and Americana. Mm-hmm. And I think alternative rock based acts tend to favor festivals because they're easier to get on bigger name festivals. You tend to get a pretty decent paycheck from it. Merch doesn't really matter too much at an alt rock festival. Yeah. Whereas Americana festivals, I think a lot of artists nowadays feel like those are being overshadowed by the greater ones. Therefore, you rely on merch, but you still don't get as much. So I think we kind of have this divide right now where alt-rock acts love the concept of the festival, yeah. but Americana artists may be feeling a little bit ignored because their festivals aren't getting that same traction.
Yeah, I can see that. There's a couple of them that some bands that I know that have played bigger festivals that the bigger festivals just aren't paying that much, which is like, hey, we got a festival and we have thousands of people that come, so you're going to get exposure and we're going to pay you not much. And, you know, that's, I don't know, it's good and it's bad, and it's the way of it,
I guess. We just had a conversation about the concept of being paid in exposure, just about, like, copyright and lawsuits, and that came up in one of our living room conversations the other day, and we discussed that the worst thing you can say to an artist is, like, you'll be paid in exposure. I think your first, like, 3 or 4 gigs, those can be exposure, and then after that it's kind of like we always pay our artists.
Yeah.
We always offer, give them something at the very least, you know, it's a hotel room or a free meal or something, because being a touring musician is not easy.
I also think, and sorry for this becoming a rant a bit, but I think it's kind of a sign of the times where maybe in the 90s or something you could afford to be paid in exposure. But the time we live in right now, it's not as affordable to be paid in exposure.
Things
are just naturally more expensive.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's like, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars impossible, but, you know, back in the day, you could play a show and be paid in exposure and get to the next city. Today, money kind of is what helps you get from city to city.
Yeah.
And I think I can't speak for the music scene in the 90s, but I also feel like previously we saw a lot more pay to play.
Like, oh my gosh, yes.
I
$50 to play, $100 to play. Like, yeah. You kidding me?
When I first started out booking, there were a couple of venues that were very much like were pay to play, and I had never seen anything like that before. And I think that as time has gone on, and I've sort of looked into booking, I hate booking. I probably will never do it again. It is my worst nightmare. But I'll look up venues occasionally, and I feel like a lot of those pay-to-play venues have gone away. We talked about that with the Herd of Main Street.
Yeah, our very first interview.
That I remember they were talking about the only people that could play in Baltimore were the high school bands whose parents could pay to rent the pay-to-play spaces.
The CD sales are almost zero because everybody's streaming stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that whole music thing has completely changed from when I first started. And it's like a whole new learning curve to try to, like, okay, how is this thing happening? How do I generate money now from streaming services?
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, I'm also going, how come people aren't listening to high def music? Because this is another avenue that we could sell at shows that maybe people would make more revenue from, because it blows CD quality away. I mean, you throw your CDs out the window. Like, if you've ever listened to like high def music, it's like, oh my gosh, it's insane. And so that's not going out there. And that might be a way to recoup some money that way, because I sell CDs at festivals, but I agree that it's not a lot, you know, because maybe somebody's buying a hot dog as opposed to buying my album.
Do you still feel like the festivals are beneficial in terms of, and we'll bring back what might end up being the word of the podcast, exposure, that you're maybe being presented to an audience that you normally wouldn't have? Do you normally get paid for festivals?
Yes.
Okay. So at the very least, there is that. Aside from being fun, you get paid, and you're, I assume, being presented to a group that you might not normally.
Yeah.
Because I guess in my mind, the way that shows are kind of structured are you have listening room shows where people are normally coming out specifically for an artist that's on the bill. You have restaurants, bars, wineries, whatever, where sometimes people are coming out for you, but normally they're there to socialize and eat and drink and have fun.
And watch football.
And watch football and not really pay attention to you. And then there are festivals where there's this bigger thing going on and you are kind of background music. I think that kind of just generally wraps up my thoughts on festivals, though. Like, I'm not a big festival person. That's not something that I like enjoy going to. So it is interesting for me to hear all of the perspectives on festivals.
There are, you know, if Merlefest called up and said, "Hey, we want you to play on the Watson stage, but we're not going to pay you anything. You'll get exposure." I'd be like, "Yeah, I'll do it," you know, because it's gigantic, you know, to get to play in front of potentially 80,000 people. Yeah. But you know, normally you do it to make money. I mean, it's like being a musician, that's how I put food on the table. So there is the exposure, there is the, I need to like kind of put myself out there to new audiences, but I have to pick those very specific, specifically, or else I end up playing for nothing and I starve.
Where are we at for time now?
Given editing, we're probably at about 33 minutes.
Okay. Because the final question that I have for you is, before we plug, is about, you write and sell sheet music, your own sheet music, and online, and also there is the book. With the amazing illustrations by your wife.
Yes.
Which we have a copy of at home.
Probably two copies. Four copies.
Okay.
it's that good, ladies and gentlemen.
It's that good. We have four copies in our house. Are any of them gifts, or are you just hoarding them?
I just give them to people when I encounter people.
Okay. That was a little offside input from my father, who's the one that has the who has the music books. What started the desire to do that? Why did you choose to, I guess, publish your music in that form and sell it? Where are you selling it? And has that been a successful avenue for you?
Okay, so my first published book was a guitar book, which is sort of, if for you guitar players out there, it's more of an advanced book about doing horizontal scales as opposed to playing vertically. Okay, I know that means a lot to you, but for other guitar players, that'll mean something. And then I have the banjo book. It's a clawhammer banjo book, banjo duets. So there's a part that has the melody, and then the next part has the harmony, so two banjo players can play together, or even a banjo player and a fiddle player, or a banjo player and a guitar player. You can work that out. But you know, I teach music, and I've been teaching since I was 14 years old, and you know, if you look at my music books, even in my music room back here, I have a stack that's, you know, 2.5 feet wide of music. And if you look at my bookshelves at home, I have bookshelves full of music books. And hello. And so when I look at those books, I see the good things and I see a lot of things. I go, man, I would totally do that differently, you know? And it, to me, it's just another aspect of being creative. So I like to write music. I like to perform music. I like to record music. And writing it down in book form so that I can help teach. Just, there's just a lot of different things that I'd like to do, and that's just one aspect of it. And the banjo book, you said if it was successful or not. And it's like, yeah, I mean, actually, I've sold more books overseas, like in, you know, it's sold some in Germany and some other countries, because I sell through Amazon, so mm-hmm. I can see who's buying it, which is really cool. And so if you go on Amazon, if you type my name into Amazon, Kevin Neidig, CDs will come up, my books will come up, and you can just order them right through there.
I wonder why the overseas sale.
I don't understand it.
Like, yeah, why that
Spotify's the same way. I can see exactly who's listening to my stuff, where they're listening to it, and it's like, oh, there's somebody in Vietnam listening to my album. Okay, that's awesome.
You say you like to write a lot of music. Do you write the music specifically, like you curate it specifically for these books?
The banjo book is all like public domain tunes.
Okay.
I've just arranged those tunes because they're tunes that everybody would know, that you could just go into a jam session and play them. Mm. You know, so they are not original pieces for that. And the guitar book is not music per se. It's more about playing scales and finger dexterity and things like that. It's a rut buster book.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good for plugs?
Yeah, if you're ready.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought of a follow-up that I wanted to ask. You said you started teaching at 14.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit about teaching off mic, but what got you into it so young? I mean, even 14 is very young to start teaching.
I had... When I first started taking lessons, I was taking lessons off of this woman who had a bluegrass jam session at her house. And I would go there every Thursday. And this other guy, I don't know how he ended up there, but he would go there and he saw me playing at 14 and he was like, "You're awesome. I want to take lessons. I'll pay you $5 a half an hour to teach me how to play like AC/DC and stuff like that." And I was like, "Okay, I'll do that." And so he would come over to the house, we'd go to the basement and, you know, just teach him AC/DC songs and power chords and things like that. And he would give me $5. And at 14, I was like, "I got $5,
yeah."
You know? So that, I don't know, that was the first time that, well, I made money before then, but that was the first time that I was like, you know, I can really do what I love and make money off of this. So I just kept doing it and got more students and, you know, taught other kids that I went to school with. And so that's how it happened.
And you've mentioned through the interview that playing kind of came naturally for you growing up. Did teaching come just like, you know?
Yeah. It was, my first student, he was, he wasn't the easiest person to teach, which was really awesome for me because it made my brain just go, how do I teach this guy? How do I get what I know that I learned so quickly into his brain and out of his fingers? And I really thought about it, and that really helped me, you know. And but teaching, I don't know. Not everybody can teach, and it's like not everybody can play music. It's just a something that is either have it or you don't. And I've always been of that nature. Like I said, I'm very nerdy about things. Like if I learn something, I learn it so I can teach it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I want to know it inside and out. And that is like a whole lot of different subjects. I mean, we could probably talk all day long about a whole lot of things, but that's kind of how I roll. And, you know, at 14, it just pushed me along in that direction. It's like, oh yeah, you're a teacher, do this. Universe says, here's a student for you, get started.
Hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Now we're good for plugs.
Now we're good for plugs.
Have these students gone to great success?
I've had great success. I don't know. I've had, out of hundreds and hundreds of students, I've had one student that became awesome.
Well, excluding me, do you have anybody else that's...
No.
I was going to make a joke about you, and then I lost it. But I think my joke was the same as your joke. Plugs.
What was my joke?
That you're the greatest...
I wasn't
most
joking.
...accomplished student.
That ain't no joke.
I am the most accomplished student.
He is.
And did he tell you about his banjo tattoo?
No. You have a banjo tattoo?
We're getting tattoos.
What?
By the way, she's on the shop until 6:30 tonight if we want to go after this.
I want video that for me. I want...
You know the Banjo Fun Day logo with the bird and...
Yeah.
We're going to do something that's based off there. Of that.
That'll be awesome.
I can see what I'm playing.
Right?
To remind you to just keep playing banjo.
Put it in my hands every day.
Just forget what you're playing. Like, oh, that's what I'm doing. Yeah.
I forget that you're playing banjo. I look down. It's like, oh, yeah, no, I'm playing banjo. I forgot about that. That's important. Plugs. Where can people find you? As far as music, website, this is coming out in 2 weeks.
2 weeks, so you'll be 1st of August.
So, okay. Anything important where people can come and see you after August 1st, when this gets released?
Yes, kevinneidig.com, KevinNeidig. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/kevinneidig. On my website, I have my... tour dates, they're all in there. You can find out. I play in a mandolin ensemble. I play in a gypsy jazz band. I play in another duo called Voxology. Most of the stuff I do is my solo stuff, but I do those other projects as well. That's all on the website. Have a brand new CD out now. So you're listening to this in August. So it's out now. You can find that on my website. You can buy it at shows. It's on Spotify, Apple Music, all of those fun things. Yeah, did I miss anything? Oh, and I like we were talking about teaching. So I teach, and I teach online lessons. They're correspondence lessons, so a lot of people that don't have the ability to come see me in person, work schedules, they're too far away or whatever, I do the correspondence lesson is that I find out where they want to go. I make a lesson video for them. I email that to them with their music, and then they can work on it whenever they want, and then they can email me with questions or anything like that, and then when they're ready they make a video of what I showed them, and then I can watch that video and then I create another lesson. So it's not like we have to do it in person. It's not like a Skype thing one-on-one. It's more flexible than that. Yeah, so that's, and you can find that if you go to my website. There's a link on there if you want to sign up for correspondence lessons. You can send me an email saying you want to do it, and you can set it up right on the website.
Awesome.
Did you plug your website by name?
Yes.
Okay. Yep, kevinneidig.com.
All right, guys, that does it for this interview. Thanks so much for tuning in. Be sure to tune in again next week. We post every single Wednesday. We are available on iTunes, Podomatic, and Google Play Podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Follow us on Facebook at The Flat Nickel Podcast. Make sure to drop us a like, a favorite, a subscribe, a 5-star review wherever you're listening, and we will be sure to get another episode out to you guys next week.